supported a proposal because they saw a personal benefit. But I still think through this process, we as a governing body get to look fresh at the recommendations. And so if you were to say that you're concerned about the conflict, fair enough. But what really resonates with me is, and I think the height should not be above X in the West End, or I don't agree with the transfer of FAR, or I think this, because we have a chance to look at this fresh. So I just want to draw that distinction, but also let you know that there is a big update on boards and commissions.
I really appreciate that. And in fact, before coming to Portland, I served on a lot of different advisory committees and one thing or another. And in the state of Virginia, they have very strict conflict of interest laws. If you have a conflict of interest, first, you must disclose in writing. And then if that property comes under discussion, you must leave the room and you may not vote on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and those are other possibilities. And frankly, again, I don't want to let us off the hook here.
Yeah,
I think there has been some chronic confusion about who does qualify as a public official.
I think
and
that's
what
true.
Body of law applies.
Yeah, I think
and
that's
I don't
fair.
Think that's on citizen volunteers to figure out. I think the city has to be much clearer about what we're asking someone to do, what their role is, what body of law applies, whether their emails can be obtained through public records.
Right.
And so there are some long overdue changes coming.
Yeah.
But I don't think it prevents us in this forum from addressing concerns you or anyone else have about the specific recommendations.
I think that some of the conclusions, specifically, as I said, on and certainly for the West End's heights, they were never really discussed because there was nobody at the table to discuss them. I was part of the public and came in and was limited to 2 minutes each session. Those issues that I raised were never discussed. Those things were passed on consent agenda, as a consent agenda item. So I do think that the building heights in the West End, the FAR issues, they've raised the FARs, and actually RX and CX, there are a number of issues that were just never discussed. So there, I will.
Thank you,
Matt. And they weren't discussed all that much at council either. Commissioner, I agree with everything that you said. Also, this process was identified as how we were going to correct the problems that the Ombudsman found.
Mm-hmm.
So it is up to us, and that's why I was asking the question about which particular properties should we look at more closely in this process. We've got two new members of the council.
Yes,
we really
I appreciate
do,
that.
Need to take a fresh look at the whole area.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm David Dixon. As a West End resident, I love to walk north along 10th Street to the library or Powell's, to the First Unitarian Church on 12th, to Artist Repertory Theater on 15th, to the Portland Thorns games at Providence Park. I love the old churches, the restaurants, the shops, the apartments, the occasional historic residents. They all come together in a slower paced, comfortable, and walkable part of town that is unique to this city. Often when I head south on my return trip, I catch the streetcar. It's generally packed with a diverse group of Portlanders. People are always considerate to make seats available to the many elderly residents of the West End who do their business in the city by public transit. The West End is one of the densest areas of affordable, subsidized housing in the city. Many seniors, low-income people, and people with disabilities are my neighbors. I treasure my community and fear what would happen if more and more older structures were to be torn down and replaced with tall residential or commercial buildings. Would elderly people find space on overcrowded streetcars? Would they dare walk on busy streets? Would Section 8 apartments be replaced by market-priced residences, depriving Portland of an already inadequate supply of low-income housing? Would my walks become more perilous through Pearl District-like traffic, sunless wind tunnels, and cold concrete and glass storefronts? I don't assume that affordable housing would survive this change. I urge the council to protect affordable housing and the unique livability of the West End and set 100-foot limits on building height. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and first of all, I would like to thank the City Council for all the time and effort you've put into making our city such a wonderful place. My name is Rick Kasky, and I have recently immigrated from the Pearl District to the West End. As a resident of the West End, I very much want to encourage the City Council to enact and enforce the 100-foot building height limit in the West End and to keep the FAR at 6.1, ratio of 6:1. And the reasons are it makes the area comfortable and accessible and friendly for locals and tourists. It helps preserve the feeling created by the many historic buildings that we have in the area. New buildings will then blend in and reinforce the existing feel of the neighborhood. And it will reduce incentives to demolish the historic buildings in the neighborhood and encourage their rehabilitation and reuse. And it will provide a transition from the tall buildings in the downtown area to the shorter buildings in the neighboring districts. My second favorite city on the planet after Portland is Paris, France. The central part of Paris is an excellent example of the positive effects of limiting building heights and encouraging utilization of older buildings, which they in France have done for decades. On a similar topic, one of the wonderful aspects of living in the West End for locals and for the many visitors that we have is the South Park blocks. To allow tall buildings on the sides of the blocks would totally change the ambiance, making it more cave-like than park-like. And tall buildings would block the sunshine and therefore run the risk of negatively impacting the trees, plants, bushes, grass, and other vegetation that make the park blocks so appealing. So I highly support the concept of limiting the heights of the buildings that border the park blocks to 75 or 100 feet. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony.
The next three are Richard Lowenshown, Andrew Plambeck, and Shelley Romero. And they'll be followed by 29, 30, and 31, Steve Leathers, Courtney Ferris, and Adam Segal.
Good afternoon.
Mayor, commissioners, thank you for the work you've been doing, and I thank you for allowing me to offer my testimony on the draft. I'm a property owner and resident in the West End, and as a resident, I think it's very important to preserve the community feel that comes with the limitation on height for the many new buildings expected in our area in the coming years.
Could you give us your name for the record, please?
I'm sorry, Richard Lowenshown. Many of the older buildings in the West End are attractive and should be saved. For this reason, I support the proposition to explicitly encourage reuse, rehabilitation, and seismic upgrade of buildings within this area. I also support the proposal to require protection of sunlight for the park blocks. Greenery and light are important to our community and very much at risk from the shadows of tall buildings, such as that of the Ladd Tower. For the West End, I support an FAR of 6:1 with 100-foot maximum building height, which would still meet the city's density goals. At the same time, it would discourage demolition of these older buildings and support renovation. I have protested earlier against the conflict of interest among the developers who voted on the liberalization of building heights and zoning, and that's been amply covered here. I would just reiterate that I think the height and zoning recommendations in that area should be revisited, and residents of the communities involved should have a voice in the decisions. As anyone who has visited Europe will confirm, the most attractive urban areas are those that have been spared aggressive development through the ages, and thus retain some of their original character. An occasional tall building can be a landmark. A grouping of them creates sunless, windy canyons without views for anyone. The West End is both a cultural and a residential area, and tall towers bring a population density far beyond what this area was designed for. Totally off topic, I just want to support strongly the opposition to building a $500,000 freeway. I've lived in Los Angeles and San Francisco and Chicago, and every time a new freeway got built, all it did was create more density on the freeways and more expansion of traffic.
Thank you.
Half a billion.
Yeah. My apologies.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Andrew Plambeck. I'm the Region 1 Government Liaison for the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I'm here to talk about the I-5 Rose Quarter Project, which is the result of the I-5 Broadway Widener Interchange Plan, which was adopted unanimously by the City Council and the Oregon Transportation Commission in 2012. The project received funding in state gas tax dollars from the legislature earlier this year. It'll add an auxiliary lane and shoulder to I-5 between the Fremont Bridge and I-84, creating a direct connection that will reduce weaving and merging to improve safety and operations without adding any additional through lanes. In addition to the highway improvement, the project will remove the Broadway and Widler overcrossings, rebuilding them as an innovative lid over I-5, creating new open space and better east-west surface connections through the area. The project also includes a bicycle and pedestrian bridge at Clackamas Street, a key connection for the city's Green Loop concept. As ODOT moves into the environmental assessment on the project, we look forward to the city's partnership and an equitable process that builds on the planning work the city and ODOT have already done. At the same time, we are investing $130 million to build the Outer Powell Transportation Safety Project in one of the most diverse and underserved parts of East Portland, with that road being transferred to the city's ownership upon completion. We are also paving and rebuilding sidewalks and ADA ramps on Southeast 82nd from Foster to King with a $14 million investment, and working closely with the city to build out safety improvements on North Lombard. Finally, ODOT is working to submit a proposal for value pricing on I-5 and I-205 to the federal government by the end of next year. Our advisory committee for guiding that work includes strong representatives for equity, social justice, and environmental justice to ensure that the proposal does not place the burden of managing congestion on those least able to afford it. We look forward to the City of Portland's partnership in all of these projects and hope the I-5 Rose Quarter project can be a solid foundation for the city's implementation of the other elements of the Central City 2035 plan, providing a catalyst for the vision shared today.
Thank you.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah, of course, Commissioner Fritz.
I'm sorry, folks. This is obviously a big issue here. If we didn't do the freeway widening bits of the project and we did all the others, would that still be funded by the state?
My understanding is no, that's not what the legislature has provided funding for.
So we can't just take that money and use it for something else?
I do not believe so.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Shelley Romero, I'm the Public Policy and Community Affairs Manager for ODOT Region 1, and I'm here to kind of tag team on Andrew's remarks. Wanted to let you know that ODOT is leading an environmental and public process, which includes a robust understanding, research, and engagement strategy of the historically wronged African-American community and other communities of color. We understand the historic inequity concerns and will engage all communities in this project. ODOT's work on the Outer Powell environmental and public process provided us with the opportunity to successfully engage upwards of about 100 folks from equity populations, including the Russian, Latino, Vietnamese, and Chinese communities, and also economically disadvantaged stakeholders, resulting in a project that is reflective of feedback from all communities. ODOT, as part of any environmental project, is required to examine the benefits and burdens to environmental justice communities in how and where projects are being constructed and how decisions are being made. We follow this legally prescribed process, but we don't limit ourselves to only including additional. We look at additional tactics and strategies that will proactively, innovatively invite broad participation and insights. As Andrew mentioned, we're investing $130 million for Outer Powell alone, not to mention 82nd Lombard and some significant improvements on I-205 between the Johnson Creek Bridge and the Glen Jackson Bridge, headed northbound and then also southbound. And for us, it's really not about, is it East Portland versus Central City? It is and should be and can be about both. Several people have brought up the issue of congestion pricing, but there has been very little mention about how equity considerations, when you look at congestion pricing on this section of I-5, would be taken into consideration. Finally, we invite and the city to join us to find equitable transportation solutions and to work with us to implement this project. It's a quick opportunity for us to take a look at implementing multimodal transportation improvements and how these may facilitate zoning changes, development opportunities, and housing. And we welcome the city as a partner to examine, aside from transportation improvements, what other opportunities may present themselves to advance the Central City Plan. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, all three.
May I just take one more personal provision? I just want to thank ODOT for all your work on the freeway barriers that we've seen going up all over the state. It's really much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next three are Steve Leathers, Courtney Ferris, and Adam Segal. And they'll be followed by 32, 33, and 34, William Smith, Randy Gregg, and Steve Bazon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Leathers. I'm here on behalf of Design Week Portland.
This spring, Design Week Portland completed its fifth year. The festival started as a grassroots collective of independent programs by and for Portland's design community. With over 300 events that span all disciplines, Design Week Portland has become the central address for design in Portland. With the community organized and activated, the festival has begun to act as an interface between the city, designers, and its citizens. The Green Loop served as a prototype for how a competition and exhibition could function as a program of civic engagement through design. This year at The Red, we worked with Untitled Studio and created an exhibition, and there was a civic engagement that received over 400 responses in regard to the Green Loop and its future. And the sentiment was overwhelmingly positive. Positive responses outnumbered negative 2.8 to 1. That's really all I have to say. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Mr. Mayor, commissioners, thank you for your time. I'm Courtney Ferris. I'm part of the team Untitled Studio that collaborated with Design Week Portland and others to pull together this design exhibition on the Green Loop. Our team spent the last year and a half thinking and listening to Portland's ideas and concerns about the Green Loop and how it could affect their community and their city. And I want to talk to you a little bit about what we've heard. So over the course of 1 week in April, an old warehouse in Central Eastside played host to a myriad of interactive activities and interventions focused on the Green Loop. From panel discussions to workshops, charrettes, prototypes, and tours, this experiment to engage Portland in the Green Loop resulted in participation of over 3,000 people. What we heard was overwhelmingly positive. The majority of people we talked with had collected comments from were excited and supportive of the Green Loop's potential, but were concerned about the manner in which it is carried out. So to us, what we heard from the exhibition was not that we should pull away from pursuing this project, but instead dig in further and find ways to address these concerns, listen very carefully, and be critical and open to trying new ideas. It's been a very exciting, eye-opening, and humbling experience to speak and interact with so many about this project. As you begin to unpack the breadth of comments you've heard today, I hope you'll take a quiet moment to read through our final report where we have gone into more detail and dream for yourselves about how the Green Loop could be part of crafting the vision and values you hope for the future of our city. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm Adam Siegel. I'm part of Untitled Studio with Courtney. And it's an honor to be here. Some of you are familiar because we've done a project together. And actually, in preparing these remarks, Mayor Wheeler, I thought a lot about your comments in the State of the City address this past March. In that speech, you spoke of a potential new West, a West Coast that will advocate progressive values in order to, quote, affirm our highest values and abandon our basic instincts. You continued, quote, in the year to come, our city will show what it means to master the basic requirements of governance and address challenges that seem intractable. We will show what it means to live our values and generate new compelling ideas. I really love that. And in an interview this past January, you expressed to us that the Green Loop is, quote, exactly the kind of innovative vision that Portlanders can get around, and it's a long-term vision that could really do a great job of defining what we want the community to be in the distant future. It's no secret to anybody here that Portland is facing a number of challenges, rapid growth, displacement, crises of unaffordability and houselessness, which continually raise the question, who exactly is this city for? The feedback from our exhibition this spring revealed that those who are critical or concerned about the Green Loop are seeing it through this lens. Will the construction of the Green Loop continue to price out and displace longtime residents? Will it benefit only the wealthy? Will it homogenize Portland's unique character and make underrepresented populations feel unwelcome? As my colleagues have been keen to remind me throughout the past few years when we've been working on this, no matter how incredible the Green Loop is, it won't be able to solve all of these issues. But as an innovative vision for Portland's future, it can be built with a strong set of core values that define the Portland we all want to see. So I'm here today to ask that the Green Loop be built truly for everyone, that it be physically and culturally accessible, that it be developed through extensive community input, especially by those voices whose voices have historically been muted, that it feels welcoming and safe even for the persecuted, that it feels as if it belonged as much to the resident of the central city as to the resident of the outer neighborhoods, and that everyone, the houseless and the housed, feels a collective ownership of this unifying space in the central city. Thank you.
Excellent testimony. Thank you.
The next three are William Smith, Randy Cragg, and Steve Bazone. And they'll be followed by 35, 36, and 37. Thomas Ray, Martha Sharp, and Dave Woodall.
Very good. And colleagues, just while they're coming up, at what time do we think we lose the quorum?
Well, we've got a 4:30 time certain, right? We're going to stop on that one.
Yeah, so here, just to update people who may have, we're obviously not going to get to everybody's personal testimony today. Again, there will be other opportunities for those of you that we don't get to today, and we'll, of course, take written testimony anytime. And I apologize that we're not going to be able to get through everybody's testimony today. We will move into the next item, and it may be that how many people are signed up for the last item?
I do not have that sheet.
Okay.
There it is.
Or is that it right there?
That looks like. Do you have the other one for the second item?
Well, we'll worry about that.
One person. It looks like.
Sorry.
Signed up for.
So we only have one person signed up for that one.
So we can maybe keep going.
Yeah. So why don't we do this? Why don't we let's add at least another 15 minutes and go to 4:45 and see where we are.
And then, it would be your intention, Matt, that people who've signed up would be called in the order that they signed up
still,
for next time?
Still, absolutely.
Yeah.
That would, I think, be the equitable thing to do. Good. Thank you. Sorry
to
interrupt.
Can I just clarify one point that was
Please.
Made? The written testimony, the record, the way it was noticed, the record closes on the 15th.
Correct.
And then it can be reopened in the future when council is taking amendments. But there is a time when the record will close for written testimony.
That is correct. Okay. And that is 5 p.m. on September 15th. So thank you for that reminder. Sorry. Thank you.
Hello, Mr. Mayor, commissioners. My name is William Smith, and I'm the last member here from Untitled Studio. There are a wide range of issues being discussed in today's City Council throughout the metro area, and compared to the scale of some of these concerns, it could seem easy to write off the Green Loop as something built only for those living in the central city. But I am here to express that the Green Loop is in fact something that should matter to all Portlanders across the metro area. We understood the Green Loop as a beginning, as a prototype to test a new way for residents to decide for themselves how the public commons in their neighborhood is developed. Already expressed by my colleagues, this brings added potential and responsibility to the project. The Green Loop could be Portland's chance to redefine and update how it does urbanism throughout all of its neighborhoods. People in all parts of Portland are starting to get tired of the old methods of public engagement, and we all know that we need to find new approaches. We need to find a new model where residents have ownership over their local commons. That is why, with our Assembling a Mosaic exhibition with Design Week Portland, we pushed so hard to share an open framework approach to urbanism where engaged residents are given the power to develop their public spaces as they see fit. This would be a model that could be replicated by different communities throughout Portland. This means a unified public work reflecting the localized needs of many communities all run directly by Portland residents. That's what the Green Loop could be. It's our once-in-a-generation opportunity to actually try something truly new. It's about far more than just the central city. It's about how Portland as a whole can grow. In coming years, Portland will have to add more alternative transit infrastructure throughout the metro area through both new and old established neighborhoods. The Green Loop, then, is our chance right now to test how to do this appropriately in a way that not only allows communities to survive but helps them to truly thrive. I am strongly for the creation of the Portland Green Loop, but only if it is truly used to push the boundaries of how Portland enables its residents to have ownership over the growth of their communities, both in the central city and throughout the metro area. The Portland Green Loop will set a precedent for decades to come, for better or for worse, so let's make sure that it's one we can believe in. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Mr. Mayor, Madam Commissioners, my name is Randy Gregg, and I conceived and oversaw the Design Week Portland's international design competition for the Green Loop. We had over 50 entries from four continents for this, and the idea captured the country's imagination of designers. $55,000 of investment leveraged $400,000 in in-kind services for an exhibition on the Loop that drew more than 3,000 people. People love this project. All of this talent and enthusiasm represents an opportunity of a generation to create a powerful new place in the city, but also a powerful new image of Portland. Great cities survive over the decades and the centuries through booms of growth and depressions and profound social change and even wars through the enduring power of their public spaces and the perception of a city that they create. Part of that is a ground game of trees and paths and benches and fountains and such, but part of that is kind of an air game of simple, easily recognizable acts of major placemaking that are visible from a hilltop or on a map. Barcelona's Las Ramblas, Jerusalem's Ben Yehuda Boulevard, Boston's Emerald Necklace. The dominant image of Portland on a map was drawn by Robert Moses in the mid-40s, the I-5 and I-405 loop. The Green Loop could change that dramatically. Untitled Studio took a concept of the Green Loop and gave us a strategy for how we can come together as a community and make that image together over time. It begins as a loop in the central city, but it can easily expand into an outward web that will knit us all firmly together. There is a campaign afoot to stop all investment in the Green Loop until, quote, advancing similar investments driven by frontline communities and areas of the greatest need. I wholeheartedly agree with the second part of that statement. But public investment is really about the leverage of public good, but also about the further private investment for that public good. The entire city is going to see unparalleled growth. Let's use public policy and investment to leverage our ground and air game so we can connect the entire city by building the Green Loop into a green web. Thank you.
Very well done. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioners. My name is Steve Bazone. Expanding urban freeways has never solved traffic congestion. I'm a small business owner, and I sat on the I-5 Rose Quarter Project Stakeholders Committee back in 2012 and have closely followed the project since. I drive, bike, take transit, and walk along the I-5 corridor daily. I breathe the polluted air along with my neighbors, and I sit in the same traffic. I participate in the public engagement process for the I-5 Rose Quarter Expansion Project every step of the way. I am here to tell you the process was abysmal. The local community surrounding the project area was not well represented and mostly ignored. Albina's black community, who bore the brunt of the negative effects of I-5 bulldozing through their neighborhood, vaporizing 1% of the city's housing stock, were curiously not at the table. Freight companies, industry, and developers dominated every meeting. When I tried to build relationships with ODOT staffers at Design Charrettes and asked for their business cards, they laughed at me. I joined with the Elliott and Irvington neighborhoods to vote no on the project. This was purely a highway expansion project from the start. ODOT knew what they were doing. They kicked things off by proposing huge flying diamond interchanges and giant off-ramps. Really scary stuff. PBOT was in the room, but ODOT was in the driver's seat. Alternative proposals submitted that did not include freeway widening were quickly swept into ODOT's recycle bin and deemed out of scope. The effect is that we are supposed to be relieved ODOT didn't bulldoze half of the Lloyd District. Including assurances of basic service improvements alongside the freeway widening was simply an effort to sugarcoat the highway project for skeptical Portlanders. It is a myth that we cannot improve the service conditions without the highway portions. We do not have to accept freeway expansions in the urban core as the ticket to service improvements. There are no guarantees the service improvements will be funded or delivered. Try tolling first. Focus on where the real safety problems are. Expanding highways does not improve congestion. We know these things now. For our children's sake, I hope we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. I urge City Council to support the request made in the No More Freeways letter. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, all three.
Next three are Thomas Ray, Martha Sharp, and Dave Woodall. And they'll be followed by 38, 40, and 42, Ron Buell, Kerry Richter, and Rose Kowalski.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, and thank you for your time. I'm Thomas Ray, speaking on behalf of more than 500 residents at the American Plaza Towers condominiums at Southwest First Avenue in Lincoln in the South Auditorium neighborhood. The Halpern Open Sequence defines our 50-year-old neighborhood and challenges us to extend its legacy. American Plaza, the southern anchor of the Halpern blocks, was participating in its evolution since 1970. Proposed tripling of building heights and FAR limits from 75 feet in a 2-to-1 FAR, under which we were built, is now proposed with bonus and transfers to a maximum of 250 feet and a 6-to-1 FAR. It runs counter to the open sequence scale and concepts and exceeds right sizing needed for sensible neighborhood growth. It jeopardizes our pedestrian character, erodes the open sequence theme, violates planning policy of building height step-downs to the river, threatens existing Green Boulevard streetscapes of First Avenue, NATO Parkway, and Lincoln Street, and the planned Greenway Loop. that will restrict viewpoints, sunlight, air, and space to the detriment of the neighborhood and promotes further congestion of two commuter roadways impacting pedestrian and light rail traffic. Our association letter to the City Council proposes two alternatives. I can only highlight one, and that is we propose to increase maximum height to 150 feet and increase FAR limit to 4-1, including bonuses and transfers, from 4th Avenue east to the river and from Harrison Street south to the 405 freeway. We welcome growth, education, commercial and residential development as we have. We seek improved services for a more complete neighborhood, and the goal is to preserve our Halperin heritage and the livability of the South Auditorium University District. Thank you, and we respectfully request consideration of these options.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate your being here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I am Martha Sharp, also representing the 500-plus residents of American Plaza Tower condominiums. Tripling the building height to 250 feet and FAR to a ratio of 6-1 in the University District South Downtown is not compatible with Portland-style living. Currently, Portland enjoys national prominence for its balance of blending people, nature, and urban development in its Halperin open space sequence. American Plaza was built at its south end as part of an urban oasis on a plaza podium design using a 2-1 FAR. This green vision was revolutionary, merging development within a hardscape that mimicked the river valleys beyond, complete with waterfalls, mountain paths, shade, sculpture gardens, and serenity. Importantly, towers and people were given space to breathe. In stark contrast, Portland could become like any other American city with monolithic blocks and deep canyons flanked by tall towers. Portland cannot afford to turn the historic South Downtown into another anonymous city. The lessons from landscape architect Lawrence Halperin must be heeded as he stated, "It isn't nature I'm after. It's humanity in nature, in culture, related all together." The proposed tripling of building height is as much as 250 feet, and a 6-1 FAR aims to undo this ethic of Portland's civic pride. It is our wish that you take this into consideration. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mayor, councilors, good afternoon. My name is Dave Woodall. I'm also one of the 500 residents of American Plaza Towers Condominium Association, and I represent the board here today. I want to thank you for hearing our testimony and for extending the session. Really appreciate that. I've been a Portland resident since 2012, and I moved to the city because of its reputation for progressive sustainability and livability. It provided a really welcoming alternative to other West Coast cities. In my former home, I served on three comp plan citizen committees. And while that doesn't necessarily make me a planning expert, I've seen the tremendous amount of work that goes into crafting a comp plan that has to coordinate policy across many disciplines. And I appreciate your careful consideration of the revisions that may not reflect that same type of careful coordination today. American Plaza has been tied to Portland's urban renewal legacy for almost 50 years. We're eager and willing to work with the Design and Review Commission to maintain this legacy, but we also recognize the need to accommodate growth. We support responsible growth through the enhancement of neighborhood livability, so we're surprised to see a tripling of current allowances for height and FAR in the South Auditorium District. Of course, it's home to the world-renowned Halperin Open Space Sequence and the last two designated upland viewpoints in the Central City. Central City 2035 prioritizes the protection of these quickly evaporating resources through the application of responsible and compatible maximum building heights and FARs. Such actions preserve our spectacular vistas. They ensure one-of-a-kind open spaces remain filled with sunlight and breeze. They support responsible growth, and they enhance our legacy of fostering a unique bond between people, nature, and urban spaces. Tripling building height and FAR in the South Auditorium District is at odds with our legacy, as well as the goals of Central City 2035. We support the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability's originally recommended increases to maximum building height and affordable one FAR as a responsible compromise, aligned with the vision we all share for Portland as one of the world's most livable cities. Thank you.
Thank you. Colleagues, my understanding is that the staff presentation on item 1000 is only about 5 minutes, and we only have one person currently signed up. Do you mind if we continue this testimony until 5 p.m. and then take a brief compassion break and then come back for 1000 at 5? Will that be acceptable? Mm-hmm. Very good. Okay, so that's what we'll do. Next three, please.
Our Ron Buell, Kerry Richter, and we'll go with Suzanne Crowhurst-Leonard. And they'll be followed by Susan Bliss, Bill Failing, and Lincoln Tuchow, 44, 45, and 46.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm Ron Buell, for 50 years a Portlander, and urban freeway expansion has never solved congestion. I was at the hearings in Salem for the transportation package, HB 2017. It was sold as congestion relief in those hearings. And in my mind, that's a joke. One can look at the $50 million widening from two lanes to three at Victory Boulevard on I-5. Travel times in that stretch of highway have done nothing but go up since the widening. Or one can look at the widening from two lanes to three of the Sunset Freeway, 26, from 185th to Sylvan. Travel times on 26 have done nothing but go up since that widening. Even PBOT, who would certainly love to have this alleged $453 million from the state for this project, won't claim that recurring congestion on this stretch of I-5 will be reduced by this widening. They won't claim it. They didn't before the Planning Commission. And the money hasn't been allocated for this project. TriMet hopes to package new taxes for Portlanders with TriMet's Southwest Light Rail Corridor measure in 2018, which would pay for this measure. Look, I support congestion pricing on all six of the freeways in our area, and we should insist that we want to see the results of congestion pricing before we expand any freeways, including this project. But that's not enough. This city council needs to develop some transportation backbone. Don Hamilton of ODOT said in the Portland Mercury that you were going to do what ODOT told you to do. And we just heard from the ODOT gentleman saying, gee, you can't transfer this money to something else. So I don't have a time to read you my list of six other projects I think you should transfer this money to, but they're there. And I'm telling you, when we transferred the money from the Mount Hood Freeway to the light rail system, and we started the 50 miles of light rail that we have in this city, I was there. I was part of that consideration. And the city council and the mayor, Neil Goldschmidt, did not have a low-level bureaucrat from ODOT tell them that they what they could or couldn't do with that money. They went to work to fight for it, and we got it done. And we didn't build that freeway, and we started 50 miles of light rail. And frankly, I think that you get some guts. Have some backbone. You know, say, we don't want this project, but we've got some things we'd love to spend this money on. Safety things and the protected bikeways on state highways. I could go on. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Honorable Mayor and City Commissioners. My name is Kerry Richter. I'm an attorney at the law firm Bateman Seidel. I'm testifying this afternoon on behalf of Conda LLC and David Lycan. They are the owners of the Roseland Theater Building located at 8 to 10 Northwest 6th Avenue. This property is located outside the new Chinatown, Japantown Historic District. It is six blocks of a Comfort property that is adjacent to the Historic District and north, directly north of West Burnside. Yet the Planning and Sustainability Commission recommended reducing the total building height for my client's property from 260 to 250 feet. The council should reject the PSC recommendation and retain the existing height limits for a number of reasons. First, it will severely interfere with the existing redevelopment opportunities for this property. At the existing 460-foot height limit, Mr. Lichen could potentially save the existing Roseland Theater, transfer the FAR from the historic building to the remaining quarter block, and build a pencil tower on the remainder parcel, and potentially join with the adjacent owner, David Gold, to realize the lost returns from retaining the three-story historic Roseland Theater. Cutting the potential building height to nearly half of what it is today will so severely impact the development expectations as to require maximizing development potential and potentially losing the Roseland. I've submitted a letter into the record, but I would point out that there are a number of the city's central city plan goals that call for supporting tourism in this area, and the Roseland plays a key component. Second of all, the property is ideally suited for accommodating more intense development. It is outside a historic district. It is not in a view corridor area. The MAX train runs along Northwest 6th Avenue, abutting this property to the west, and it abuts West Burnside with the convergence of bus service. It's hard to imagine a more transit-friendly location. This site is across the street from the U.S. Bank building, which is 42 stories and 536 feet tall. A tall tower in this area would be entirely compatible. For these reasons, we ask that you reject the PSC's proposal to reduce height on the Roseland block and retain the existing 600-foot height limit. And I apologize for my little friend.
No worries. Commissioner Fritz.
I have a question. The conventional wisdom would be that having more height would be more likely to get a demolishing and start over. So what's the reason that you think it'll preserve the existing structure rather than
the Roseland Theater is a designated historic resource. And the idea is you have a designated historic resource on a quarter block, and that leaves three-quarters of the block of non-contributing structure and parking lot. And the ability to maximize the growth there would be to save the Roseland, which Mr. Lichen has the intent of doing.
And is it possible for a property owner to just get rid of the historic designation?
Sure, there is. There's demolition review.
Yeah.
So yes, it's possible. But it's hard for me to understand why this height reduction is proposed in this six block area,
okay,
because it isn't a view corridor, is not adjacent to a historic district, and is.
Can't imagine why you can't think of what you wanted to say.
Carrie, could you?
You've been very patient, young man. Thank you very much.
I was making notes as you spoke, but just tell us again, the proposal is to reduce it from what to what again?
It's from 460 to 250.
Okay.
We'll look into it. Thank you.
And the other thing I should point out is that this property doesn't carry with it the transfer of development rights as it does in historic districts. In the historic district, these folks can transfer their development rights, but these six properties were left out, and I think that was a mistake.
Thank you.
Mom,
thank you.
Thanks for your
Mom,
patience.
I have a question.
Let's go outside and you can tell me the question.
wise mom. Thank you very much for your patience, young man.
That's a hard act to follow. Mayor Wheeler, Commissioners Udalli, Fritz, and Fish. I'm Suzanne Kurhus-Lenard, co-founder and director of the International Making Cities Livable Conferences, but I'm here to read a testimony from Michael Mahaffey, who is executive director of Sustasis Foundation, who's out of the country speaking at a conference on urban planning. I previously testified, he says, about cautionary research into the impacts of tall buildings and the dangers of what I called voodoo urbanism, that is, over-concentrating attention on the expensive cores of cities and neglecting the capacities of their many other neighborhoods to grow in a more benign way. As we see in so many other cities on the West Coast and elsewhere, the result too often is even more runaway loss of affordability, livability, and heritage, displacement, over-gentrification, homelessness, and other serious urban ills. I do believe the Central City Plan has significant defects in this respect. However, my focus in this letter is on the failure of the plan to comply with statewide planning goal 1. I believe the Council is well aware of the potential conflicts of interest identified by the City Auditor's Office requiring the remedy that members of the West Quadrant Stakeholder Committee must file conflict of interest disclosure forms after the fact. 5 members refused to do so, 2 of whom appeared to benefit financially from the increased heights that will go forward under the current plan. I believe it is therefore urgent that we restore the integrity of the planning process in perception and in reality. I believe this will require, at a minimum, a reconvening of a new stakeholder committee charged with reassessing the heights and FARs of the West Quadrant, comprising a, quote, broadly representative cross-section of affected citizens, as Goal 1 requires. I suspect they will be convinced on the evidence that building heights of no more than 100 feet will be fully adequate to accommodate a more benign, diverse, diffuse form of urban growth and so preserve Portland's priceless livability and heritage.
Thank you.
The next 3 are Susan Bliss, Bill Failing, and Lincoln Tuchow. And they'll be followed by 47, 48, and 49, Tracy Prince, Liz Cooksey, and Eric Mason.
Good afternoon.
Hello, thank you. My name is Susan Bliss. I moved to the West End 11 years ago because of its convenience and pleasant livability. But aspects of the plan on the table appear to threaten our neighborhood by inviting massive development at odds with its character. The issue is building height. Allowing structures 200 and 300 feet and higher in this area, now largely made up of residential units and low-rise small businesses, will drastically change our neighborhood and, by precedent, Portland overall. Expanded height limits will give developers the incentive they need to uproot trees, demolish many historic structures, and replace them with look-alike glass towers. Rehabilitation and expansion on a human scale is preferable to demolition, but if the city raises height limits in our downtown neighborhood, there is little hope for saving the current building stock. Not only do our older buildings give variety and texture to the urban scene, but many are also home to neighbors who cannot pay the awesome cost of high-rise living. Most sustainable and affordable is the structure that exists, not the tower that replaces an historic building after it has been demolished. According to Gerald Mildner of PSU, a building higher than 5 stories requires rent some 2.5 times the rents from garden apartment developments. A major changeover to residential towers will put more Portland citizens at a loss for homes and add to our already burgeoning homeless population. In order to curb the raising of historic buildings and affordable housing units and to preserve the character of our neighborhood, please consider limiting West End building heights to 100 feet. I also wanted to say that I support the amendments announced by Mayor Wheeler to preserve site corridors from Salmon Springs and Japanese Garden, as well as Commissioner Fritz's call for changes in height restrictions at the river level. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
How's that for a segue, going from Bliss to Failing?
That's good material, Bill. That's good.
I want to thank the commission today, first of all, for giving us the opportunity to express ourselves. And also, I really appreciated the eloquence of those who have testified today and the passion for which they have. And so it's been very rewarding afternoon. And thanks for extending the time a little bit, because I'm glad you're going to have a chance to hear Tracy Prince, who's got a dynamite presentation.
Time.
I'm really here today to just address the I think the potential threat to the view corridors, and I really want to speak up about that. I think that planning with its best intentions is letting some of the soul of the city slip away. The corridors that I think matter the most to many of us is keeping the Jefferson Street view of the Vista Bridge as you come down Jefferson. It's one of the most iconic bridges in the Pacific Northwest, maybe, and it's being threatened. And right now, there's a developer who is convinced that the corridor should be moved a little bit over to the left, and it still works. It doesn't work, and we need to take a close look at that. Mount Hood. Connecting Mount Hood to Portland, going back, it goes back to the very earliest days here. I was looking through some old records. I'm going to not be out of time here, I hope. But just a couple of lines from a letter from one of my ancestors describing to East relatives Portland as it was in 1863. The town itself looks as though it was dropped into a valley, the horizon being girded with a continuous belt of fir trees. The only peep of the outside world is Mount Hood, which looks up grandly beyond our fir ramparts, even then. So I say this, that we really need to pay attention to the viewpoints of the Mount Hood, the corridors that take the eyes to Mount Hood. One other point is, when I drive up Vista Avenue, the name of the renowned Olmsted Brothers, named by the renowned Olmsted Brothers for its panoramic view of the city and of Mount Hood, I wonder today why it's still called Vista Avenue. It's impossible to see Mount Hood from there. So Mount Hood belongs to the entire city. I think that it's the view corridors are being manipulated to accommodate developers. Current views of this proposed draft are compromised. Also, please support the proposed changes to Salmon Springs to keep Mount Hood visible to all, as our mayor said earlier. Remember, once a view is lost, it's lost forever. Thank you.
Sir.
Mayor, may I make just one comment?
Commissioner Fish.
And we do have time for Tracy, so I'm not cutting into your time. I have a comment to make about Bill that has nothing to do with his testimony. But I was channeling Bill Failing today, because this morning I attended a press conference where Restore Oregon officially announced that the Jansen Beach carousel had not only been found and saved, but it had been donated to Restore Oregon.
Right.
And now our beloved carousel is in the hands of a custodian that wants to be a good steward. And the challenge will be for our community to determine where we want to site it permanently and to enter into a fundraising campaign, because it's going to need a structure to protect it from the elements. It turns out it is of the 5,000 to 6,000 historic wood carousels built during the Golden Age. There are only 150 left. And this is...
1906 World's Fair in St. Louis, Nick.
Right, and this one is arguably the greatest living example of that great tradition. And the reason I say I was channeling Bill Failing is that the last time we had a similar challenge was when the city that owns 3 steam locomotives did not have a home for those locomotives because they were evicted by a railroad tenant, a landlord. And Bill Failing and Mike Lindbergh and a host of wonderful citizens got together. And through their efforts, we now have a new museum next to OMSI, which is home to our 3 steam locomotives. And I hope the city can summon the same spirit to create a new home for the Jansen Beach carousel.
Thanks, Nick. You had a lot to do with the rail museum also.
So thank you, Bill.
Very good. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
My name is Lincoln Tusho, and I'm a member of the Advocacy Committee for the Architectural Heritage Center. I'm also a broker with Urban Nest Realty. I would like to propose the following amendments to the 2035 Central City Plan. One is to reduce the building heights to 100 feet throughout the West End along both sides of the South Park blocks and in Goose Hollow, and two, to lower the floor-to-area ratio back to the original 6-to-1 from the 8-to-1 or 9-to-1 that's been in the latest draft. Why reduce the maximum building height to 100 feet and the FAR to 7-to-1? There are several benefits to this proposal, but I want to focus on just one, and this being it will preserve low- and middle-income housing in the neighborhood. The West End has a plethora of medium-rise vintage apartments, buildings that are not only architecturally beautiful, but affordable. I went on Craigslist just the other day to do a little experiment and compared rental prices between the older character buildings and the new high-rises in the West End and other downtown neighborhoods. And you know what? The difference is dramatic. Rents in the old buildings range from $800 to up to, say, $1,400 for studios and one-bedroom apartments. The prices in the new construction, the tall glass towers, tended to be much higher, often well over $2,000 a month and going much higher than that. If the current max heights of the CC 2035 are kept in place, there will be tremendous market pressure to demolish these vintage buildings, and we will lose some of the best affordable housing stock in downtown Portland. This proposal also supports the goal of the draft of preserving housing diversity and no net loss. The City Council, you folks, have made very impressive efforts recently to address the affordability crisis, and I applaud you for that. And this way, we can continue that. The character and historic flavor of the neighborhood will be preserved, and affordable housing can be provided. It's a win-win. Remember, the greenest and most affordable building is often the one that is already built. We can accomplish two great Portland goals with a single policy decision, and I hope you will implement this proposal. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Why don't you do three more, and then let's do three more.
Okay. The next three are Tracy Prince, Liz Cooksey, and Eric Mason.
I'd like to answer the question that Commissioner Fritz had about the map.
Let's put your name in the record, please.
What's that? Oh, Tracy Prince. That I believe the Northwest Examiner did a map of properties of conflicted SAC members, but I don't think it was complete.
Thank you.
I'm Dr. Tracy Prince, a board member of the Architectural Heritage Center, vice president of the Goose Hollow Foothills League, which is the neighborhood association. We're very proud of the fact that half of our board is low income and half are renters. We're presenting the unanimous GHFL position. In the past decade, we've seen that the more Goose Hollow fights for what's best for all residents in ways that cost developers millions of dollars, the more vicious the personal attacks. I was defamed this week on social media. I have a 105-year-old house that I bought 15 years ago, and like most of my neighbors, I could not afford to live in my neighborhood today. I have a view of Mount Hood, but none of the proposed heights will affect my view of Mount Hood. A couple of buildings might block my view of the Lincoln High School football field. Our board members aren't fighting for personal gain. We're fighting for every Portlander who hasn't had time for 3 years of reading pages, thousands of pages of code every 6 months in order to understand how much the views are being privatized and how much ethically conflicted developers are being enriched in the Central City 2035 plan. On the views. Thank you, Mayor Wheeler, for fighting to keep the views from being privatized only for the wealthy at Salmon Springs Fountain and for saving the views, or trying to save the views at Japanese Garden. We encourage all commissioners to vote for his amendments. It will only take lowering heights on a few properties to save the Salmon Springs Fountain view, the last view of Mount Hood from the edge of the Willamette River. And only vegetation management to save Japanese garden views. It's important for Portland to promote egalitarian access to public views. Please refer to the first image in our handout. We emailed a 13-page letter with complex code request. Today, we just want you to look at photos. This is what views of the Vista Bridge will be like with the proposed heights. We're asking to return Southwest Jefferson to today's protected view corridor from I-405 to the bridge and lower heights along Southwest Jefferson to save views of the Vista Bridge. If heights are built as proposed, Portlanders will only be able to see the arch of the bridge by standing underneath it in the middle of the street. heights are increased near the bridge will privatize views of the arch of the bridge only for those wealthy enough to live in a building blocking the view. The new SW72 viewpoint from Collins Circle, which is the second image I've given you, is a ridiculous so-called viewpoint of only one half of the arch while standing on the far edge of Collins Circle. BPS staff created this so-called viewpoint to allow them to raise the heights near the bridge. A staff member stated very clearly in a planning and sustainability work session that creating this so-called viewpoint was done to benefit one developer who owns property.